So again, the sources. So the sources I'm going to talk about are stellar mass black holes that inspire into one of those supermassive black holes that are believed to be in the cores of basically all galaxies. And so the LISA definition team decided not long ago that these sources are important enough and such that the noise floor for LISA is to be set according to the requirement of detecting these kind of sources. So to understand what exactly it is that we need to model, I will start by describing some general features of extreme mass ratio in spirals, especially in the context of detection by LISA. This will set for us a theoretical challenge, namely high accuracy computation of strong field orbital evolution and waveforms for generic orbits around the Kerr black hole. There has been a lot of progress on this problem in the last 5 years, and I'm going to I'll try to summarize it. Most of the progress was made along this two line of avenues of approach. Both of them rely on perturbation theory. They differ in the way they account for the radiation reaction decay of the orbits. The first one is based on, this is a traditional one, it is based on energy momentum balance consideration. I will describe some recent results and also explain why this method is eventually limited and why people recently spent a lot of time pushing forward the second alternative approach, which is based on local cell force calculations. Here we also made a lot of progress on, this progress was made on three steps. The first one was understanding issues of principle, like regularization and gauge. And we think that we have a good control of that, a good understanding of that. The good news from last year is that we now think we have a good practical method for cell force calculations that actually works. And I will also tell you about ongoing implementation of these methods. So massive black holes are abundant. Astronomers postulated the existence of supermassive black holes in the cores of galaxies for a long time as explanation of the energy outcome from AGNs, and later also they show us some nice circumstantial evidences. But the most impressive evidence came just a few years ago, especially with the Hubble Space Telescope, in the form of measurements of individual stars, the motion of individual stars and gas clouds in cores of galaxies. So this is the census of supermassive black holes as of March 2001, 2 years ago. There are a few more since then, but at that time there were already about 30 of them. And you see that the masses vary with something between 10 to the 6th and 10 to the 9th. You can also see that they appear to be in all kinds of galaxies, elliptics and spiral are here. They are classified here by detection method. These were detected by looking at motions of stars, motions of gas clouds, and maser emitters. The first one here is the one in our own galaxy. It is the best known example and also the one in which the mass is best constrained. So, and there is one at the Andromeda galaxy, one at the dwarf companion of the Andromeda galaxy, and basically at each galaxy that AGST is looking at, we see a massive black hole. So they are everywhere at all of the galaxies, basically. There are evidences that supermassive black holes are rapidly rotating, and there are some. Yeah.
Are there also known examples of galaxies?
No. Every nucleated galaxy shows a black hole at its center, the one that has a well-defined nucleus inside. Okay. As far as I know. And very recently, I also read some reports about mid-sized holes, something of about 1,000 solar masses. that astronomers could see in the middle of globular clusters. Sorry? Sorry?
Where?
In globulars. Yeah. Sorry, photographic. So this one that I chose to quote here is based on kind of estimating the contribution from quasars to the luminosity of the universe, and then implying back to what should be the efficiency of the energy conversion. Yeah, and then you find a value which is higher than the value that a non-rotating black hole should give you. Then you can constrain the rotation rate, the average rotation rate. At least this one, I think there are other circumstantial evidences. Let's move on. So that's about the massive black holes, and now let's move to the food, to the thing that these massive black holes are going to feed on. These are the stellar objects in the cores of galaxies, and here is some statistics that I picked up from some unpublished notes by Stowell Finney. They show the main classes of objects, main sequence of white dwarfs, neutron stars, and black holes, each with its average mass, the percentage by mass and by number. Now, main sequence stars are not qualified, do not qualify as sources for LISA, simply because they will be tidally disrupted and torn apart long before they could produce any interesting signal in the LISA band. So this is why we are talking only about compact objects when we deal with LISA sources. Now, you can see that white dwarfs outnumber neutron stars, which in turn outnumber the black holes. But since the strength of the gravitational signal is proportional to the mass over distance, detection rate would be proportional to the mass cube. And if we take this into account, we find that the proportion reverses. And in terms of detection rate, we will have much more black holes that we are going to see. Now, this assumes that objects are selected randomly, which they are not. In fact, there will be even further bias toward black holes because the captured cross-section is higher, the higher the mass is, and also because dynamical friction acts more effectively on higher masses in driving them down. So this number should not be trusted too much, mainly because there is a large uncertainty about the mass function, but the conclusion is most likely to survive, which is that if LISA sees one event per year, it's most likely to come from 10 solar masses black hole. Yeah.
So those figures you have, is that based on theory or
the what?
Is that based on observations or on theory, these figures of percentages?
Well, it is combined. This is the person to ask, actually. But I think it is combined, and it's a rough estimate. It's very much model dependent and so on.
So
model population of stars and galaxies, in cores of galaxies. There's a great uncertainty here, yes, that's for sure. But because the ratios are so large, and because there will be even further bias toward black holes. Okay, now how it works, how the capture mechanism is going to work. This picture that I'm going to show you now is based on early works by Hills and Bender and by Sigurdsson and Riis. And it should go like this. An object in the core of galaxy, a compact object, it gets distorted by another object and then falls toward black hole, which is represented here by this X. There is a minimum value of the angular momentum which defines a loss cone. If the compact objects happen to fall into that loss cone, it means that it's going to be captured by the black hole eventually. Objects that fall into that loss cone will have very high initial eccentricity, this value. Now, the first time they pass the perihelia, they emit some, the perihelion, they emit some amount of gravitational waves. This gravitational wave will be still far out at the Lisa band. We are not going to see that. But it will make the orbit shrink a little bit, such that next time it will be smaller and smaller, and until eventually it enters Lisa band. After typically after 10 to the 6, after a million years, it will enter Lisa band at about 2 millihertz. And during this process, the eccentricity will get smaller and smaller. Radiation reaction makes the eccentricity get smaller and smaller, but it will be still significant when it enters Lisa band between 0.4 and 0.6. Of course, we would like to take that into account when we go to model this system. Now, one side remark here. I said that this initial radiation will not be seen by LISA. It may cause some problem, however, because some of it may leak into very high harmonics of the waves and into the LISA band. And that may be a potential source of a new source of confusion noise, self-confusion noise. This system will get confused from other systems like this, which are farther away, or which are farther away, which are in the path of the evolution. And currently at AEI, Kurt Cutler and myself are studying this new source of confusion and trying to evaluate what it means in terms of detection by LISA. Anyhow, the main signal will come only after 10 to the 6 years, by that time the orbit will, I'm sorry. By that time, the orbit will have a frequency of about a few millihertz, and the eccentricity will have this value. Now, during the last time, between the time the compact object gets into LISA band and until it hits the ISCO, it falls into the ISCO, there is another full year or even a few years during which this object is still going to give us something between 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6 orbits straight into the most sensitive part of LISA. As I said, there will be gradual circularization, but still substantial eccentricity even as the particle reaches the ISCO, maybe about 0.3. Now, Sigurdsson and Riss estimated the rate of these events by once per 10 to the 8th times per galaxy. One to the minus 8 times per year per galaxy. Well, once each 10 to the 9th year at every galaxy, which translates to about 1 per year out to 1 gigaparsec. They said, however, that this is based on a very conservative model of the mass function, and it might well be that the rate may go to about 1 per month with less conservative mass functions. They also commented that if there is only one solar mass, 150 solar masses compact object at its galaxy, we are going to see them from the entire universe, and we are going to see a few of them each year. Another interesting way of looking at the evolution of this system is plotting the strength of the signal against Lisa noise curve. So the thick curve here shows Lisa noise curve averaged over the sky and normalized to 1 year of integration time. This calculation was done by Finn and Turn 3 years ago based on the energy momentum method that I'm going to describe in a few minutes. And they show the evolution of systems this plot shows the evolution of a one solar mass black hole falling into a 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole at 1 gigaparsec for circular orbit. Each of these plots shows one particular mode or harmonic of the orbital frequency for a specific value of the spin parameter. And you can see that And there's a lot of information here. 1 year before the plunge, the system still has something like 500,000 cycles to give, and it's already at 3.26 M, very close to the event horizon. 1 month before the plunge, there is still 66,000 cycles to give, and 1 day before the plunge, still 2,400 cycles to give. So it's amazing how much time, how long this particle just stays there, lingers around the black hole, giving us many, many, many wave cycles, all of them inside a very, very strong region, a strong field region of the black hole. This is very different than other Inspiral sources that people are familiar with. Now, the last thing that I would like to show you is the large signal-to-noise ratio. That's the ratio between this curve and that curve, which is about 10 here. And if you look at 10 solar masses, it goes to about 100. We are going to see this object with a signal noise of about 100. Finn and Thorne estimated the signal to noise as 10 times the mass in solar masses over the distance in gigaparsec. Now, this was, as I said, for circular orbits. At AEI, Kurt Cutler and myself have done the same, produced the same plots for eccentric orbits recently, and we got this, similar numbers. However, well, signal to noise of 100 looks like very high. However, the detection rate is very uncertain, mainly because we don't know how difficult the data analysis is going to be. We don't know if this 100 is going to be enough for us or not. This is a problem, another problem that we are trying to study now. So the data analysis is difficult, I said, and the reason is that the parameter space, the physical parameter space, is huge. There are 17 parameters for this problem, which means that we will have to build up a huge bank of templates for that. There's no chance in the world that we can integrate coherently over a whole year. We will have to do something more sophisticated, like stacking, coming up with some hierarchical method of doing this kind of data analysis, and this is something we are studying now, a group in AI and group at Caltech. It means that we are going to lose a lot of signal-to-noise due to discretization of the template, and it means that we better be very good doing the modeling. We better get very accurate templates. How accurate? Since the phase scales like the number of orbits, the fractional accuracy that we are going to need in the phase scales like must be constrained by 1/N of cycles if only we want to achieve an accuracy of about 1 radian. This is necessary. So 1/N of cycles is something like 10^-6. It means that we need to get the waveforms correct within a fractional accuracy in the phase of 10^-6. If only we would like to get an accuracy of 1 radian. So let's summarize the theoretical challenge that we are facing. It is to compute orbital evolution and subsequent waveforms through fractional accuracy of 10^-6 for large mass ratio, small mass ratio between 10^-4 and 10^-8. For generic orbits, inclined and eccentric, circular are not good enough. Around Kerr black hole. And here I put a small footnote which says that one simplification assumption that we can probably make is assume that a small object doesn't have spin. Because the mass ratio is so small, the spin of the small object will not have a big effect on the waveform. There are some works showing that explicitly. There was some concern that a spinning particle may show a chaotic behavior, which would be disastrous for match filtering. But there is a nice work by, very recent work by Mike Hubble showing that shows no sign of chaotic behavior if the mass ratio is large. So no spin for the compact object. Now, just very briefly, what are the scientific payoffs from looking at this kind of sources? So the basic thing is that this object spends a lot of time in a very strong field of black hole and gives us a lot of wave cycles, and therefore it is a very efficient probe of space-time. It will allow us to map the space-time around the supermassive black hole. For example, all we need is to measure three multiple moments of the black hole to disprove the no-Hare theorem. And it will test alternative theories in gravity, also allow us to measure very accurately the parameters of the massive black hole. So Ryan, Fintan-Ryan estimated the resolution of LISA to the mass by 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5, and of the spin by 10 to the minus 2. We at AEI recently completed, that was done for very restricted orbit. We at AEI did that recently for non-restricted orbit and found even a better value for the spin, also 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 5. That's very encouraging, very nice. And as I said, it is interesting enough that LISA scientific team decides to set the floor level of LISA, the floor noise, noise floor of LISA, according to the requirement of detecting the sources. Now, what are the possible sources for modeling waveforms for these systems? Post-Newtonian methods are well developed, but in our case are not useful, because all the signals come from very close to the event horizon, a very strong field. Full numerical relativity, I've seen a very recent paper, which I think is the first attempt to do it with full numerical calculation, by Bishop Gomez, Husalener, and Winnicker. And I think they calculated only one orbit around the Schwarzschild black hole so far, I think. But it would be very interesting in the future to compare this to other approaches when these calculations become more developed. Most of the progress was made along this way, expansion in 1 over m in the mass ratio. The basic idea is to assume that, or to model the compact object by a point particle, which moves on a fixed background, and then use black hole perturbation theory, which is well developed. Everyone knows how to do it. There are two variants for this approach. One is based on conservation, and the other one is based on local force calculations. Let's start with the conservation law. Very briefly, there is a lot of work was done on that basically since the 70s. Maybe the most sophisticated works are those of Scott Hughes for circular orbits, circular inclined orbits in CAIR, and those of Kostas Klampedakis and Dan Kenefic for eccentric equatorial orbits. The basic idea is the following. First, we assume that the evolution is adiabatic. It means that the time scale for radiation reaction effect is much larger than the orbital frequency, or the orbital time scale. And it is justified because this ratio is roughly proportional to the mass ratio, if the mass ratio is large. And based on this approximation, that means that the evolution is, the particle is more or less geodesic along a few orbits. Now, what we do now is solve for psi 4 with geodesic orbit, parameterized by the energy, angular momentum, and the Carter constant as a source, using Sasaki Nakamura formalism. And then from the flux at infinity and through the horizon, we infer the rate of change of the three constants of motion. And then we can feed it back to our code, change the trajectory, and calculate the new waveforms. How this is done in practice? There are a few methods of doing that. One very useful is the one that Scott uses, which is to build a radiation reaction grid. So this is the phase space for this particular problem that is studied of circular orbits around CAIR. This is the radius. This is the inclination angle, iota. And at each point, he drew an arrow whose horizontal component shows us what is R dot, and the vertical component shows us what is I dot. So first of all, he builds this master grid, and then it can evolve orbits along this grid given any initial data, and these orbits will look like this. So each of these horizontal lines is an orbit starting from a different place in parameter space until it hits the ISCO, which is this dotted line. And here you have the number of cycles in phi direction, theta direction, and the time that it takes until the ISCO. So that was done using the energy balance method. There is, however, a problem here. We can calculate Q dot, the rate of change of the Carter constant, only for a restricted family of orbits. There are orbits for which this Q dot can be read off from L dot and E dot. This is not in general the case. Q dot cannot be read off the flux at infinity. So this can be done for all orbits in Schwarzschild, also for all circular orbits in Kerr, also for all orbits in the equatorial plane in Kerr, but not for general orbits, which is what we need. And this is where this method fails. And this is why people started to look at the alternative method, which is the method of the local cell force. Now, the idea is, again, simple. The particle, which it is now a particle, emits, has a field of order m, and this field exerts a cell force back on the particle at order m squared, and then we can write this extra term here in the geodesic equation of motion. So that's the geodesic equation, just a zero, and we had another term here of order m squared. I wrote it in this way just to make apparent the analogy between this and a familiar Abram-Lorentz Dirac force for an electric charge in flat space. I hope people are familiar with this. So that's the Abram-Lorentz Dirac force, and this is the cell force, which is proportional to the electric charge squared, and it's analogous to the cell force that we are looking for, the gravitational cell force. There's no M, but there's no term proportional to M because there's no pure gravitational force. And given this F that now we are going to look for, we can either directly integrate the equation of motion or obtain the rate of change of all constants of motion, including the Carter constant, using a simple formula that relates it to the components of the force. Now, this equation of motion, Abram-Lorentz-Dirac was first generalized to curved spacetime by de Witt and Brehm in 60. And funny things happen at curved spacetime. This is the world line of the particle. The particle emits radiation. This radiation gets scattered off spacetime curvature, and then it can interact back with the particle later on its evolution. It means that when the particle it's here, the cell force that acts on it depends on the entire past history of this particle. This is called a tail effect. A nice illustration of this tail effect is a case of just if you just put a static electric charge inside a shell, a massive shell, you can actually calculate and see that there is a net cell force that acts on this, and it's just proportional to the square of the charge, in spite of the fact that this particle just sits in flat spacetime locally and fills just flat space around it. So that's the tail effect, and the tail effect comes in when we calculate cell forces in curved spacetime. The first ones to generalize the formalism of cell forces to the gravitational cell force were Mino Sasaki and Tanaka, and independently Quinn and Wald in 97. I won't describe it. So this slide is intended to describe the way they made the regularization, how they obtained their expression for the cell force. And the main idea was that it's very rigorous and based on very good physical considerations. It's not containing any arbitrary regularization. But I won't have time for this. I'll just show you the result of this calculation of this regularization by Mino Sasaki, Tanaka, and Quinn and Wald. And the result is the following. The cell force is given as a certain integral over a certain derivatives of a Green of a certain Green's function, calculated along the entire past history of the particle. So the integral is carried out from minus infinity, the infinite history of the particle, until just before the particle is, and then the limit is to be taken. Now it's a nice feature of the gravitational forces that it contains only tail effect. No contribution is coming from directly along the line cone. There's only the tail effect that contributes to the force, no contribution from the light cone. This, the gravitational cell force is a purely tail effect. That was the expression that we were having something like 3 years ago, and the question then of a group of something like 20 people that was interested in this problem was how to make a practical method out of this. One way toward making this more practical is to write this force as a field, first of all, the tail field, which is defined everywhere in space-time. Just at this point, the tail field is calculated by integrating along the world line up to retarded time of that point. That's the tail field. And then writing this tail field as the difference between two quantities. The full field, which contains both contributions from the tail and the light cone, minus the direct field, which contains only the light cone contribution. This gives us exactly the tail contribution. The useful thing about that is that this full field is something that we know how to calculate, because it is just related to the normal perturbation equation, that the normal perturbation, metric perturbation, that we all know how to calculate, just solving the perturbation equations. Okay, so that was the first step toward writing a practical calculation scheme that was done by Amos, Ori, and myself. And the idea is very simple. Just imagine that we know how to decompose this into multiple modes, to decompose the tail force, tail field into multiple modes in this way. Then we find that, let me say that again. The good things about this decomposition is that each of these modes is finite. Even at the particle itself, even when this x goes to the particle, we find a finite quantity. The multiple decomposition kind of smears the singularity. This is an unknown effect. Now, of course, when we sum up all these terms, we recover the divergence. And what we find in general is that this goes like L. It goes linearly with L. So imagine now that we know how to characterize the divergence of the full multipoles and of the direct multipoles. The divergent piece will have a form like this, A times L minus a constant minus a term over L, right? So now, if we knew what these A, B, and C were, we could subtract them from here and add them here, by which we are doing nothing, but getting two divergent sums in this form. Now, basically, A, B, and C could be achieved by just exploring the local behavior of the direct force at very high L numbers. So this is basically a local calculation, and why one might hope to do it analytically. So A, B, and D are local quantities, and also all this sum is a local quantity, because the direct force is a local quantity. That's the null cone contribution. Now, the holy grail for a group of people during the last 2-3 years was to get these parameters A, B, and C calculated for as general situation as possible. Last year we finally were able to do it for all equatorial orbits in Schwarzschild, this group of people. The good news from this year, there is a paper that was published just a few months ago, that we were able to get this A, B, C, and D for all orbits in Kerr space-time. So now we have a complete prescription for calculating the cell force. And to summarize this prescription, we do the following. First, we solve numerically Tokolsky, Saki, Nakamura equations with a geodesic source and get psi naught or psi 4. Then we construct the metric perturbation. The metric perturbation itself is needed for the cell force. The size are not enough. And for this, we can use the Walter-Chernovsky formalism with a small appendix by OI, which accounts for the inclusion of a particle. Then we construct the full force modes, using a simple equation, these derivatives, we have them explicitly. And once we have these modes of the full force, we can use them in the what we call the mode sum formula and get the cell force. These A, B, C, and D are quantities that we have now analytically. So that's a prescription for calculating the local cell force. Implementation. This formalism was implemented already for a few cases. First for the scalar cell force, more recently for the gravitational cell force by Carlos Lusto and myself. And we are now working on the first really interesting case, which is circular orbit in Schwarzschild, the first case in which we could actually compare with other with calculations based on energy momentum balance. One interesting thing that we found is that we can actually push the same local analysis that we used for calculating the regularization parameters A, B, and C one order further, and get actually an approximation for the cell force at large L. And this turns out to provide a very good approximation for the cell force itself. I won't be able to show you plots. Yeah. Okay. So it was an interesting problem, the gauge problem. Well, if I have 2 minutes, maybe I can speak about that. So that was a problem that concerned that for maybe the last 2 years or so, our entire community. And the problem is the following. The local cell force turns out to be a gauge-dependent notion. It depends on the gauge. When we do a gauge transformation to the background, the metric changes, also the cell force changes. Now, what we are interested in is gauge-invariant quantities. And those we can derive from the force in whatever regular gauge, whatever gauge in which the force is well-defined. Now, the problem begins with the fact that the prescription that we were given by Mino, Sasaki, Tanaka, and Quinenwald was formulated in the harmonic gauge. And so to implement the mode sum scheme, we need the modes of the force in the harmonic gauge. However, what we know how to calculate from perturbation theory is the modes of the perturbation in a different gauge, normally the radiation gauge or the Reggie-Wheeler gauge in Schwarzschild. So we had to find a way of somehow converting the gauges or reformulating everything in terms of the radiation gauge. The first thing that we found, the interesting thing, is that these parameters are actually gauge invariant in the sense that if you put here the force, the modes of the force at any gauge, you get the force at that particular gauge, given that this force is well defined. Only if this force is well defined. The problem then was that the harmonic gauge that we had to use is ill-defined, is not well defined. The force in that gauge is not well defined. Actually, one finds that if you put a particle and then calculate the metric in the harmonic gauge, which everyone uses so much, you find a singular ray which is emitted from the particle, a singular null rate which is emitted along the L direction, along the null vector. So the cell force is not well defined, I'm finishing, in the radiation gauge. The solution that we came up with, that was very recently, is the following. We build up an intermediate gauge, which is both regular, that is to say that H is singular only at the particle itself, and also very simply related to radiation gauge. In fact, what we've done is just taking the radiation gauge and just twisting a little bit the local form of the gauge of the metric just in the neighborhood of the particle, such that to make it more similar to the harmonic gauge. But because the change is just local, we can actually work out explicitly the gauge transformation and find the metric in this new gauge transformation. What we get is a gauge that is regular, and since we can work out explicitly the gauge transformation, we could find out what term should be put here in order to compensate between the fact that we're using the radiation gauge here and the intermediate gauge here. So recently we were able to calculate explicitly this compensation term, and now we can calculate the cell force in this regular intermediate gauge and get the gauge invariant quantities out of it. That's all. Zero. Yes. Concluding. Okay. So next, we would like to compare outcome from cell force calculation with conservation on low calculation in the longer term full numerical calculations. And the ongoing works on circular orbit in Schwarzschild will provide the first opportunity. Then, on the plan for next year is to implement this cell force calculation approach for generic orbits in Kerr, something we are about to work on in Texas. And in the longer term, we would like probably to include also second-order perturbation theory and second-order cell force if we would like to reduce the error to less than 1 radian. Thanks.
Question. You mentioned a bit about the template counting. Can you say a few more words about that? Because it, at priori, it looks like a huge template base, but you've been working on actually trying to see where it actually can be made a lot smaller.
Yes, that's what I wanted to talk about before you told me that it's not interesting. So it is. So the idea is that you cannot do a coherent match filtering over a year because you will need something of like 10 to the 50 templates and you don't have enough computer power. So your computer power is limiting you and it tells you how long you can do the integration. Okay, you need. And what we find using what we found is that we can probably do just short sections of about 1 week of integrations. So the idea would be to cut this 1 year of data into pieces, one week long each, then do a coherent search along this along each of them, and then combine the signal to noise in some clever way from all these different sections. But we are just working out this technique, and we don't have it complete yet. We just have some estimates of number of templates and so on, signal to noise. Oh, yes. So out of the 17, there appear to be something like 9, between 7 and 9, which are actually important and will have to be taken into account. So the spin is 3 parameters. 2 of them are important. There's the 2 masses which are going to be important. It depends how you parameterize your system. I will have to explain that in details. But for example, the direction between the plane of the orbit, the angular momentum of the system and the spin is another important parameter. The eccentricity at some fiducial time is going to be important. I think the 3 most important parameters are the eccentricity, the mass, the capital mass, the mass of the big black hole, and the size of the spin of the big black hole. That's the 3 important one, but there are other important ones. I have another talk ready on that if you.
Lior. Question. So I recall Eric Poisson raising this issue about the second order perturbation theory possibly being necessary. Is there any thought in the past year whether the full calculation is going to be needed, or might a sort of use the self force to correct the geodesic motion as you go along, provide the phase correction, and potentially give you all of what you need to get that one part in a million?
You mean
correction.
Second order force?
No.
Because you need a second order perturbation theory formalism to be able to start doing that, right? You need to be able to calculate second order corrections to the metric.
Well, so you had the geodesic motion, and then you
yes.
use it to calculate the first order perturbation.
Yes.
So the question is whether or not you might be able to feed the effect of the force into the geodesic, correct the geodesic
yes.
motion as you go along,
yes,
and get the phase correction.
But this will give you only part of the phase correction, right? Another part will come from second order perturbation theory acting on the first order geodesic, right? Which is something that you don't know how to calculate
and
right now.
And that's the question, whether or not.
So there are some attempts to do second order perturbation. I know one paper by Campanelli and Lusto, but I'm not aware of any other attempts.
Any other questions or comments? All right, let's thank our speaker again. The last